Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Bill McGonigal is retiring from the Boston Housing Authority this July after 40 years with the agency. He started there as a janitor in the 1970s, but since 2009, he's been the head administrator. The Boston Globe's Adrian Walker described him as, quote, the landlord for Boston's poorest residents, unquote. He oversees 25,000 tenants in public housing and provides housing subsidies, including vouchers, to 25,000 more. He joined us in studio to speak about what's kept him at the authority all those years.
First and foremost, I grew up in public housing in Boston and the Mary Ellen McCormick housing development over in South Boston, first public housing development built in New England. So I had an interest in public housing and public housing advocacy literally from the day I was born. And I've always had a desire to help people, and I thought that there is no better way to accomplish that goal than to be working on behalf of the poorest and most marginalized people in the city of Boston.
So you really did set out from the beginning for a life of service in this kind of capacity.
Yes. I mean, there would not be a day in my 67 years that I have not had some connection, some relationship with the Boston Housing Authority, either as a resident, as someone that is working with residents in another capacity outside of the Boston Housing Authority, or as an employee of the Boston Housing Authority. So clearly this has been my life's mission.
So you grew up in the McCormick. How have conditions in that particular public housing complex, for example, changed from when you lived there to when you started the job to now?
A couple of things. Certainly it is a lot more diverse than when I grew up there. When I grew up there, it was a predominantly Irish Catholic public housing community. Most of the public housing in our city was segregated at that time and reflected the racial and demographic makeup of the surrounding neighborhoods. Right now, the Mary Ellen McCormick Housing Development, the population there speaks roughly 28 different languages. It is one of the most diverse census tracts in the United States of America, so that is certainly a significant change. The other thing, quite frankly, is it's older, and as a result is in significant need of a major capital improvement, and that is one of the three developments where we are moving forward with a public-private partnership to rehabilitate and to preserve all 1,016 deeply affordable units in that community via a mixed-income approach. What we will be doing is leveraging the value of the land, and that is indeed very valuable real estate, to help subsidize, cross-subsidize the development, rebuilding of the deeply affordable housing there.
The fact that public housing today is less segregated, significantly more diverse, you actually had something to do with that. It's something I'd love to hear more about. Back at one point, you were the executive assistant to former director Doris Bunty, and your main goal in that role was to racially integrate public housing in Charlestown and South Boston, which were mostly all-white neighborhoods at the time. That initiative really was the result of an NAACP lawsuit in 1988. Tell us a bit about the political climate at the time that you started doing that work.
Yeah, I had a role in, a visible role in that effort. But again, as I have indicated always in the past, I don't want to take too much credit. Again, I think the real heroes of that integration effort were the Bessie Paynes, the Liz Klingscales, who were the first two families of color to move into South Boston.
Why? Why were they the real heroes?
Well, they were the ones that took the most risk, quite frankly, and they were the ones that were the pioneers and took the chance to move themselves and their families into a community where, in some instances, they were not terribly welcome.
How did that manifest itself?
The overall result of that effort was, I would suggest, better than many had predicted. I think if we keep in mind that in 1987-88, when we began the integration effort, it, from a historical perspective, that was really only a minute away from the busing crisis.
Of 1974.
74, 75, 76. So from a it was a decade apart, but from a historical perspective, it was really a very short period of time. My experiences with that effort, at least within the public housing communities, that is that although there were some incidents, some terrible incidents, some racial incidents, there were hundreds, even thousands of positive interactions that I saw and witnessed each and every day that were not of interest to the media. I spent a great deal of time in those communities in Southie and in Charlestown on those days interacting with all of the residents, particularly the residents of color, and saw, again, hundreds, thousands of positive interactions on a day-in and day-out basis.
Did you feel that your own experience growing up in public housing in Boston gave you a particular credibility to speak to both the white communities and families of color during the process of integrating South Boston and Charlestown's public housing?
I think one of the things I am most proud of in my tenure at the BHA is, quite frankly, my trusting relationship that I've been able to establish with the public housing residents all over the city.
Despite your credibility with the public housing residents and your official role with the Boston Housing Authority, you actually faced violence during that time of attempts to desegregate. Can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, at one point early in the morning, my BHA vehicle, marked vehicle, was parked in front of my house in Southie, and somebody took some shots at it. I think four or five bullets were shot into the vehicle.
Were you in the vehicle at the time?
I was not. I was actually upstairs shaving, quite frankly, and my wife and a couple of my kids were downstairs in the kitchen having breakfast. I thought at first it was an engine backfiring or something, but I did look to the window and I saw a car, a late model dark car, racing away. In any event, my family was safe and sound. And I continued my work at the BHA and was not going to be deterred from my work by any kind of act of violence.
Bill, in 2016, the U.S. Census Bureau ranked Boston as one of the most highly segregated cities in the country. So I'm curious, do you think Boston successfully desegregated and is now resegregating, or are we as segregated as we've always been?
Clearly, the public housing communities in the city are integrated, no question about that. I think there needs to be some work done to further integrate both racially, ethnically, and economically, quite frankly, many of the neighborhoods in our city. And we just recently announced something that we think might help that, the small area fair market rent proposal that we just announced and that the Boston Globe has endorsed editorially. We are hoping will open up some of the neighborhoods of our city to our voucher holders, but not only neighborhoods of our city. I think when we look at and talk about integration, I think we have to look at it from a broader perspective, from the perspective of Greater Boston. There are many surrounding communities in Greater Boston that are predominantly white and are economically and racially and ethnically segregated, where I think we should concentrate some efforts. We should not focus exclusively on Boston, although I think there's some work to be done there. There are other cities and towns in Greater Boston and in Massachusetts that need to step up to the plate as well.
Can you explain a little bit more about the proposal that's just received endorsement in order to provide Section 8 housing recipients or voucher recipients with money that's tied to the cost of living in the community where they might live?
Sure. The current funding arrangement is that it sets one fair market rent for a one, a two, and a three-bedroom unit. And obviously, setting the same rents for Newton and the same subsidy for a voucher holder in Newton versus Lynn or versus Dorchester does not make any sense. The fair market rents and the rental markets in those neighborhoods and those cities are very different. And the way it has been set up for years, the subsidies for our voucher holders did not provide enough funding to rent in those neighborhoods. So
rent in more expensive neighborhoods.
Absolutely, in more expensive neighborhoods. And we've adjusted that, made some significant adjustments to allow our families, our voucher families, to compete, economically compete with the rental market in those cities and towns.
Why is that important to allow residents who receive vouchers to be able to live in other cities and towns in Greater Boston?
For me, it's real simple. It's that poor folks, in my view, poor folks ought to have some choices about where they want to live and raise their families, just like folks with significant economic means. The current arrangement of one FMR and one size fits all has basically segregated poor folks and concentrated poverty in several different zip codes.
FMR stands for fair market
rent. Fair market rent, yes.
So the state, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, seems to be pushing back on this idea of adjusting for fair market rent in different communities. Why do you think that's happening?
I'm not sure. I don't want to speak for them. I will. There was a letter to the editor, by the way, from Chris Norris, who administers the voucher program for the state, supporting our approach. So I'm not quite clear what the issue is with them, but I, again, would strongly encourage them to follow our lead and to take Chris Norris's advice.
I'd love to hear what you're hearing from the public housing residents with whom you work. This is a city where to have your own apartment, at least according to a study that was out last year from an apartment search engine called NestPick, you need to make over $78,000 a year. Your average resident makes $15,000 a year. What are they saying to you?
It never ceases to amaze me, quite frankly, how our families are able to make do. I mean, their rent is set at 30% of their incomes. And if someone has zero income, and we have some of them, I was taught, I think, in the fourth grade, 30% of zero is zero. So we have some zero rents. But even if you're averaging $15,000 a year in income, and your rent is a few hundred dollars a month, that doesn't leave a lot on the table for food, for clothing, for your children. I am always amazed at how creative our families are in providing for their families. And it clearly has to be and is an economic struggle for them.
Talking about the creativity and I might even suggest resilience, as you have, of residents who are making it work on $15,000 a year is a different way to talk about low-income communities in Boston than we hear from some other voices. You are known as and respected for your anti-poverty advocacy in general. How important is anti-poverty advocacy in today's Boston?
Extremely important. The cost of living in Boston is going up. I do think that the BHA, is following a path of redevelopment that will preserve all of the deeply affordable units that we have. I think the city, the mayor, and Sheila Dillon are doing a wonderful job. We're producing affordable housing units at a pace that has never been accomplished in this city, but it is still a struggle to keep up. One of the things I would suggest is that it is time for the federal government to reengage and to step up to the plate and commit some financial resources to the development of affordable housing in Boston and in Massachusetts and throughout the country. They have retreated. They are running away from adequately funding the public housing program, and they're running away from the development of affordable housing here in Boston, in the Commonwealth, and throughout the country.
Can you explain in a little bit greater detail what the funding situation looks like for public housing in Boston right now? Where is the funding coming from? Where is it increasing? Where is it decreasing?
The vast majority of the public housing in Boston is federally subsidized. There's a formula that HUD actually established, the federal government established, as to what a housing authority would need to adequately operate their properties. This is the minimum amount of money that the federal government says a housing authority would need to adequately operate on a day-to-day basis. We have not been funded at that level that the federal government says we need in decades.
Interesting.
So about 10 years ago, we were at roughly 83% of what the federal government says we need. Now, when you've got fixed costs, like you got to pay the heat bill, you got to pay the water bill, you got to pay the electric bill, the only place to cut has been personnel, and we are actually a couple of hundred employees down from where we were over a decade ago. So it has gotten a bit better in recent years. I think this year we're at about 93% of what the federal government says we need, but that's still 7% short of what, by their own formula, the federal government says we need to operate effectively.
Given the shortages in funding on both an operating and a capital basis for the housing authority, how do you think we can afford to peg fair market rents to the cost of living in various communities to allow people to move around in Greater Boston and have greater choice in where they live.
Two separate funding, two separate appropriations bills. The leased housing program is funded separately from the operating in the capital. And quite frankly, the leased housing program or the voucher program has always had significantly more bipartisan support than the public housing program. And I think there's some obvious reasons for that. The voucher program generates revenues for the private sector. If I'm not mistaken, the Kushner and the Trump empires, real estate empires, have benefited, financially benefited, from the leased housing program over the years. So there is big money, big real estate developers that make money off of the leased housing program. So as a result of that, I think it's been able to generate support not only from Democrats, but there seems to be some interest from real estate interests and moneyed interests to keep those programs going as well.
On the question of funding, in April, the Walsh administration announced its intent to increase funds for affordable housing and homelessness initiatives in Boston by almost 45%. Some city councilors say even more needs to be done. How do you think about the relationship between homelessness and housing in Boston today?
You know, clearly they are linked, inextricably linked. But I would say that, in my view, this mayor has put more city money on the table for homelessness, homelessness prevention, and for public housing. We're currently redeveloping the third phase of the Old Colony public housing development over in Southie due to a $25 million grant that was given to the BHA by the city. He just committed $30 million to the redevelopment of the Bunker Hill housing development, the first time in the history of the city that any mayor has contributed city capital dollars to public housing. I believe this city and this mayor is doing everything they can do within the confines of their limited budget. Again, this gets me back to, we cannot let the federal government off the hook. We cannot continue to point the finger. Locally, we got to start looking down 600 miles south of Boston to what's going on down in Washington, D.C., and what they are doing or not doing to provide adequate funding for affordable housing and public housing in this city and in this country.
So outside of the question of housing, what other initiatives would you like to see either the city or the federal government investing in for the most vulnerable and most low-income residents of Boston?
You know, I think one of the things, the homelessness problem is driven, at least to some degree, not entirely, but there is a lot of or a significant problem with opioid addictions as well. I mean, when you walk up and down the streets of the city, in my neighborhood, quite frankly, on Dorchester Street in Southie, the evidence of the opioid epidemic and its impact on homelessness is quite obvious. It's there for anybody to see. And I think the city and the federal government stepping up to the plate around dealing with that crisis, and I think the mayor's initiatives around reopening the Long Island shelter, I certainly think that is something that would be a huge step forward in terms of providing services. I think the job training would certainly be something that is helpful, job opportunities. I think providing adequate daycare for families. How does a single mom with three kids who doesn't have access to daycare go out and find herself a meaningful job where she can't leave her three kids at home all by themselves all day? So I think there's a combination of factors, social factors and programs that government, the city, the state, and the federal government needs to provide funding for and support for that can more effectively deal with the homelessness crisis that we're seeing all over the country.
When you look back at your 40-year career, what do you hope will be your legacy?
I hope my legacy is one of inclusion, someone who made a sincere effort to open up the public housing in the city to residents, applicants, those in need of housing of every racial and ethnic background, and that I empowered residents and listened to them and brought them to the table when it came time to make decisions.
That's Bill McGonigal. He's the head of the Boston Housing Authority. He's retiring after 40 years with the authority on July 26th. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Hey, stay with us. Coming up, we're going to have author, journalist, and pop culture critic Chuck Klosterman. He's going to join us in the studio to talk about his new collection of short stories, Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.